Great, thank you. So my name is Andrew Solomon. I'm the project manager for the Northeast Telehealth Resource Center, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about what that is. I have a background in public health. I have my MPH from Boston University, concentrated in epidemiology, and I haven't done really any epidemiology since then. That's okay, because I'm really excited about telehealth, and I think there's a lot of great potential here. Just curious, how many of you are familiar with telehealth? Well, good. And how many of you are actually involved in a telehealth program? Well, good, a few. So, no relationships disclose. A couple things I hope to do in this presentation, very briefly go over our consortium of telehealth resource centers that are federally funded, talk a little bit about what telehealth and telemedicine is, set that foundation, some of the current limitations around policy for telehealth and how that maybe is preventing more growth in the telemedicine field. And then I'm actually going to have a colleague come up and talk a little bit about telehealth in rural areas and what's happened there and maybe where we might be going in the future. And then if we have time, just a little bit on how telehealth is a public health tool and maybe how we can embrace that a little more here at APHA. So HRSA, the Health Resources Service Administration, has the Office for the Advancement of Telehealth. And OAT funds 14 telehealth resource centers around the country. And just curious, is anyone familiar with the telehealth resource centers? Oh, good, good. So we have 14 centers funded to help organizations and individuals start telemedicine programs or telehealth programs. And that's really anything from looking at reimbursement policies, what can a provider get paid for via telehealth, developing business plans, looking at HIPAA-compliant or HIPAA-compatible technology, and really anything in between. And if you're interested in learning more about the telehealth resource centers, telehealthresourcecenters.org is our website. So we have 12 resource centers around the country that are regional, covering all 50 states. And I'm from the Northeast Telehealth Resource Center, covering New England, New York, and we actually share New Jersey with the Mid-Atlantic TRC. I'm based in Augusta, Maine, but work closely with this network of 12 centers. And then we also have two national centers. One is the Center for Connected Health Policy based in California, and they track all of the current and pending legislation around telemedicine, which is a really hot topic for us right now. And then we also have the Telehealth Technology Assessment Center based in Alaska. And they're sort of like a consumer reports for the technology. They buy the equipment, test the equipment, and release toolkits to help providers and other organizations decide what might be the best option for them. But as federally funded groups, we have to stay vendor agnostic, so we don't recommend any one vendor over the other. And we have a lot of different resources available, some really great information available on our national website. Our two national telehealth resource centers have great websites. On the Center for Connected Health Policy site, you can go on and look at your state and see what policy is pending, maybe what bills have been introduced related to telemedicine. And then on the TTAC website, the Telehealth Technology Assessment Center, they post toolkits, a lot of really interesting information about the new technology that's coming out, and some really cool things in the pipeline. So has anyone seen this picture before? I think this is just so cool. This was from a magazine written in 1925 in the Science and Invention magazine, and the author wrote about what he called the teledactyl. And he predicted an instrument which could feel at a distance. And he said at that time that they had the technology available in 1925 to build this using radio. The physician could control the instruments on the physician's side, and at the distant side, those little hands would move with the patient. And they could diagnose from a distance using a television screen, which I think is such a cool thing and is exactly what we're doing today, and they thought they could do it in 1925. So this is our definition of telehealth, and there are a lot of different definitions depending on what you're involved in. This is very broad. It's a means or methods for enhancing healthcare, public health, and health education using telecommunications technologies. And there's a lot of different technologies available to do that. These are two other definitions I pulled from the Illinois law, since we're in Chicago. They have a definition for telemedicine, which includes evaluation and treatment when a patient is at a medical provider location and the rendering provider is at a different location. And then they also have a definition for telehealth, which talks about the location of the patient and the expertise of the provider. It could include different types of technologies, text, graphics, still images, audio and video, and they include real-time synchronous services and asynchronous store and forward services. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. And we see both of these terms thrown around quite a bit, telehealth and telemedicine. Telemedicine was more common in the past, but telehealth is a more universal term. It includes other disciplines such as dentistry, counseling, home health, others. And it also includes professional and patient education, which I think is a really important piece. So the American Telemedicine Association hasn't changed our name yet, but we're telehealth resource centers, and we really focus on that term. But we include both. So we also include four types of telehealth: the live video synchronous services, so using video conferencing technology to connect to a provider in real time, and there are a lot of different uses for this. We also talk about store and forward services, so asynchronous services. Radiology is a really common example, taking the x-rays and sending it to the provider to look at, maybe at a different time. Teledermatology, I think, is a really neat example, taking an image of the skin, sending it to a dermatologist who can look at it maybe later in the day or the next day and determine if the patient needs to come in for a visit right away, or maybe they can wait to 6 months when they have an opening and come in at that point. We also look at remote patient monitoring, so the idea that we can take internet-connected scales or blood pressure cuffs, send those home with the patient, have the patient use those every day. That data is automatically sent to the provider, and some software with an algorithm will look at that data and determine if there's a data value that's of concern. It'll red flag it. Maybe a nurse can look at that and decide, oh, this patient needs a phone call, or maybe they need to come in for follow-up, and how can we utilize that to improve our health and maybe reduce 30-day readmission rates after a hospital visit. And then we also included mHealth or mobile health and the use of our smartphones and tablets, and that can certainly include these other three types of telehealth, but using those services and connecting maybe to the patient's home when they're at home, and if they have a tablet, we could video conference with them, we could have them send images, or maybe we could use that tablet to collect vital signs like their weight or blood pressure. And there's a number of really interesting telehealth uses. This is just a list of some of those, from behavioral health to wound care. Certainly, telehealth can't be used for everything, but a lot of really great examples available. And this is just a quick snapshot of some of the possible benefits depending on what type of telehealth service you might be developing. Certainly for rural care, the increased patient access to providers through reduced travel is a big, big benefit. And not needing to travel to the urban medical center and stay at your home rural center to see a specialist. And certainly timelier access to providers, maybe through the teledermatology program, where you can get into the dermatologist in maybe a week or two rather than the 6 month waiting period. Some other benefits could include reduced use of institutional care, improved access to training and other educational services, reduced complications, and certainly patient satisfaction. A lot of great evidence out there that patients love telemedicine or telehealth. But there are some challenges. Those could include the startup costs and connection fees for providers and for patients if they want to receive services at home. Available connections, especially in rural areas. Does the healthcare facility have broadband? Probably. But does the patient's home or other facility have broadband? Maybe not. Need for training and workforce development. Are providers comfortable using telemedicine or telehealth? Is it incorporated in current training? Are physicians learning about telemedicine and their education? My fiance is a medical student, and they haven't talked about telemedicine and telehealth at all. So certainly some room for improvement there. Increased staffing demand as these services come on board. Provider pushback is a concern. Does a provider want to integrate these services into their existing workflow? Do they have time to do that? Certainly can be a challenge. And then the slow and confusing legal and regulatory landscape. As telehealth resource centers, we get questions all the time about licensing requirements, reimbursement, what can I get reimbursed for, who is reimbursing for telehealth. It's different in every state and very confusing as folks start these programs. And I think this is one study out of thousands that are available. This is an early study, and I think it's really interesting, by Murphy and Bird, based at Massachusetts General Hospital at this time. They established one of the early telemedicine connections between MGH and Boston Logan International Airport for their medical station there that was serving both travelers who had emergencies and the employees of the airport. And they did this study with 1,000 patients. Most of them were employees. Very successful connection, although I think it's really interesting to think they published this in 1974. It was based on patients seen in 1968 and 1969. and just imagine the type of technology they were using in the 60s. But then they also looked at patient satisfaction as part of this study. And they asked patients, how satisfactory was your own experience in seeing the doctor over television? And almost 69.1%, so almost 70% of the patients said that it was about the same or better than in person, which I think is just amazing considering what their technology was in the 60s, and then think about what we have now available. And there's hundreds of articles about patient satisfaction out there, a lot of really interesting uses, and patients love it. And as I mentioned, the policy is a big barrier. Some of the things we look at, probably the most common question we get as a telehealth resource center from providers in the area is reimbursement. What is Medicare reimbursed for? They have some limited policies. Fortunately for this group, since we're interested in rural health, most of Medicare is reimbursing for rural areas and none of the urban areas. So that's great if you're in a rural area, but we get a lot of questions from people that are maybe mixed and they don't fit in, all of their patients don't fit in the rural area, and how can they develop this telemedicine program if they can't get paid for it. Medicaid and private insurance varies by state. A lot of states have started to reimburse for telehealth services, but it really varies between what type of service they reimburse for, what's eligible. In Maine, they have a pre-approval process, so a provider has to be approved every year to be reimbursed before they can be reimbursed for their telehealth service. So that's certainly a barrier for those folks. And a lot of private insurance companies have really started to embrace telehealth. I have Blue Cross and Blue Shield in Maine, and I think once a month I get an email about their direct-to-consumer live video urgent care service. So I can go online and talk to a provider, and they may prescribe or diagnose the flu or pink eye or really common things. They may write me a prescription, and I can do all of that, I think, for $45. And there's a lot of companies out there doing that, so a big push for that. But it's hard for us to track what's really happening because they don't always want to share their policies, which is no surprise. A lot of professional standards and regulations are developing. A lot of medical boards are looking at this and deciding what's appropriate for providers to do. Licensing requirements can be a challenge. A physician needs to be licensed in the state where the patient's located at the time of service. So as providers look to reach across state lines, there's some difficulties there. Internet prescribing, what constitutes a patient-physician relationship and when can you prescribe medication? Do you need to see the patient in person first or not? It seems like a lot of medical boards are leaning towards, as long as you have the live video interaction, that's sufficient. But if it's just a telephone call, then that may not be. And certainly HIPAA concerns, what sort of technologies can I use to stay HIPAA compliant? And then malpractice liability, what are the malpractice concerns if I'm providing services through telemedicine? Some really interesting things happening today. The Center for Telehealth and eHealth Law looks at Medicare reimbursement. And in 2014, they reimbursed $13.9 million, up from $61,000 in 2001, which is really great. They're growing, but considering the yearly budget for Medicare, it's a very small part of what they're doing. The VA is very involved in telemedicine and telehealth. They included $1.2 billion in their 2016 budget for their telehealth services, particularly connecting to their VA patients in rural areas. And in 2014, they serviced almost 700,000 patients. There's a lot of really interesting studies out there talking about the growth of the telemedicine market and how much it'll be worth and all of that. So some promising signs that telemedicine or telehealth is growing quickly and will continue to be a major factor. And then there is a strong collection of evidence-based peer-reviewed literature around all these different types of specialties utilizing telehealth. And certainly the traditional focus and still is the major focus for telehealth services is for health access in rural areas and connecting the rural patient maybe to a medical, to a specialist in the urban medical center. And so I'd like to actually invite Elizabeth Kropinski up to talk a little bit about her experience in rural telemedicine and some of what she's seen and maybe where we're going. Elizabeth is the director of the Southwest Telehealth Resource Center. And since we have this great network of folks all around the country, I always hate to give a presentation without tapping into some of their expertise. So, that's it.
Thank you. I just want to briefly talk about some of our the keys to success, in a sense. We've been in Arizona. Our program was established in 1994, and there's a variety of other programs within the state that got set up at the same time in northern Arizona. If you think of Arizona, it's Tucson and Phoenix, and everything else is rural. So very rural state, and our region covers Utah, Colorado, and New Mexico, and parts of Nevada as well. So they're all very similar in terms of cultures, diversity, and so on. But we've seen a lot of success, and actually I want to concentrate on the non-academic, because I think academic telemedicine is really kind of going away in a sense. It all got fostered there, it grew there, but it really is becoming much more of a phenomena outside of the academic healthcare centers. And what's been key, I think, to some of the programs in Arizona, NARBA, the North Country Healthcare Provisions, is one, they're multi-institutional and collaborative. And this really kind of harks back to the nature of rural medicine in general. They already have a lot of connections because there's a lot of all these small hospitals, clinics, and so on. They have informal networks already established. And so when you start to talk about utilizing technology to connect them, part of the problem is already solved because they already know each other. And they already meet in a variety of circumstances and refer patients to each other. So that part is there. This is just adding a layer to it. The stakeholders are incredibly diverse. We're not just talking CEOs and medical directors. The people who come to these meetings to establish telemedicine programs in these rural areas they're the nurses, they're the tech people, they're the physicians, they're just everybody comes in. And I think that's absolutely critical to have that buy-in early to have success. And then a lot of these programs, what's led to this success is a dedicated effort to start with planning, to implementing, and I'm an experimental psychologist, I deal with human factors and ergonomics. The main thing is integrating. Telemedicine, telehealth is not about the technology, it's the people. It doesn't matter what that technology is, it's getting people together. And so it's the integration of telehealth and telemedicine into the workflow and making it work there and addressing all those human needs that's really gonna make it succeed. My best advice for those of you who want to get into it is to start small. Showed a lot of specialties that are used. We started out from dealing, got everything we could possibly think of at an academic medical center. We got all these experts. So let's do OBGYN, let's do rheumatology, let's do that. We did them all. And then we figured out, okay, wait a minute. Step back and let's just pick the ones that really work. So if you're just starting a telehealth program, I recommend taking the low-hanging fruit and start with that. Telepsychiatry is real easy, teledermatology, diabetes care, and these types of programs really, really work. But focus on all the components. Like I said, technology is like this. The rest of it is getting the people together, figuring out how to integrate things into workflow, your administrative, some evaluation people, marketing, some policy, having all the stakeholders and people involved in the beginning will get you there. Establishing protocols and utilizing clinical guidelines. Andrew mentioned there's a ton of guidelines out there. The American Telemedicine Association, I'm chair of their Standards and Guidelines Committee. We have about over a dozen for different specialties as well as in general. And really it's all about collaboration. And what we're seeing now is actually, like I said, moving away from academia, we're also seeing a huge influx of direct-to-consumer by health service providers, as well as these companies that are establishing themselves to provide help to a lot of rural sites to establish their telemedicine programs. They provide the technology, the connectivity, the clinicians, they credential them, they license them, they train them, and they will come to you whether you've got 5 beds or 20 beds or 400 beds, and they will help put telemedicine into your practice, and they'll provide the service. And sometimes it's a lot easier to do that because they'll also have the connections into the reimbursement than to actually go out and try to get a grant. Because these days, grants to go and kind of do this are becoming less and less available, to be perfectly honest. So those are some of the keys to success that we've seen in Arizona. And I'll hand it back to you for conclusions.
Can you stay with us for questions?
Yeah.
So my last slide here, telehealth and public health. Does telehealth fit into the 10 essential public health services? Is it a public health tool? And I think the answer is, of course. These are just a couple of those 10 essential services that I pulled out. Can we use telehealth to monitor health status? Of course. Can we use it to diagnose and investigate? I think so. Inform, educate, and empower people about their health issues. Link people to needed personal health services. So I think absolutely. So I noticed last year there was a few telehealth presentations at APHA this year. There seems to be more this year, so I'm really excited to see telehealth begin to become more of a public health issue.
Thank you. So any questions for Dr. Kubinski or for Andrew about where telehealth fits in all of this? Yes, please.
As with any innovative concept, there's sometimes some unintended consequences, like, I think about the emergency room and kind of inappropriate utilization. For some patients and people, their only social interaction ever is to get up and get showered and put together and go in and see their provider. Is that big enough to be on the radar? How might telehealth, hit that off at the pass and address it, or can you speak to that at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually, the remote monitoring and the mHealth really, it adds to it. What we've seen is that a lot of hybrid programs work. So, for example, you've got patients who are sent home from surgery, and they need to have that home health nurse come, or they have to go to the hospital. It's a hybrid model of combining telehealth with the regular interaction with the physicians. And that really seems to have even more positive outcomes, because you've got that mix of that personal contact, that motivation to get up, plus you're typically a nurse calling into the patient's home, whether by phone, whether it's by Skype or cell phone, whatever, and making that regular connection. And more, it's being reimbursed to do that. So it's really the hybrid. I don't think there's that much of a challenge, and that this is just going to suck it up, and the patients are going to be stuck at home, and they're going to lose their motivation, because that really seems to work so much better.
Okay. I'm from Florida, and we are going into year 3 or 4, I'm not sure which, working with our resource center to try and get the legislation through the legislature that allows us to do this. And it is nightmarish. I mean, it's a slam dunk. All the cases that you make are just absolutely perfect, and everyone recognizes, most everyone recognizes, and they've seen it. But the big issue that keeps being tossed in, other than professional silo issues of who can do this, the nursing students, is the issue around fraud. So the question that I have is, because rural health, we've done this before. We've had home health went out, and we started paying for stuff, boom, we had home health, and it was on 60 minutes. The next in line was rural health clinics. And then, boom, it went crazy, because these are all capitalist enterprises. So Dr. Kubinski, you were noting that there are folks out there that are doing this for ERs, for all kinds of things, for pharmacies. They are doing this with telepharmacy and everything else. What do we need to do? What do we need to be aware of? How do we address the immediate concerns about all of our wonderfully entrepreneurial capitalists who are going to come out of the woodwork to make lots of money, because there is potential here, and hopefully kill a really important workforce goose?
The fraud has always been a concern. It's been a concern. Yeah, it's evil. But it was a huge, huge concern starting even 20 years ago when telemedicine really came and revitalized. There has been little, if no, fraud reported in telemedicine. A lot of the companies are having to go through very rigorous credentialing. The American Telemedicine Association developed an accreditation program, and the companies that want to provide it, to give them sort of an added credibility, have to go through this credentialing program or accreditation program. So there are ways to get in touch with companies. It's buyer beware, as with anything else, but there are mechanisms coming into place to help, not regulate or police, but to monitor the field. There's been, like I said, very little fraud. And as far as I know, and maybe you know if there's been more, there has been one malpractice case in telemedicine. And that malpractice case was a patient who said, I should have been treated with telemedicine. It's the standard of care. You did not. So I'm suing, and that patient won. I don't know of any other malpractice cases. So, I mean, it's surprisingly, when you look at it as if we're simply doing medicine in a new way rather than, this is telemedicine, it's something special, it's different, we have to regulate it, we have to approve it. If you can convince your legislature that it's just another way of doing it, and your resource center plus a lot of the other states that have had legislation and connect up with the CCHP, the Center for Connected Health Policy, because they have like templates of language that you can use, as does the American Telemedicine Association. They'll give you templates. This is the kind of language to take to your legislatures.
Just before you go to the next question, do you want to talk about the Interstate Licensure Compact?
Oh, yeah. The American Board of Medicine came out earlier this year after so much fighting with them and getting them to recognize cross-state licensures, because nurses have this already. And they said that it is up to the states, and if states want to join together and allow licenses to be cross-state for telemedicine, states can, for medical doctors, do compacts which allows to cross-state. So you just have to get into the agreement, and there's a number of states that are picking up on it. It's not the same thing as getting a universal license. We don't want to push the AMA too far. But it was like a revelation that we finally got them to do that, and that helps a lot with these regulations, because cross-state is a huge, huge issue.
And you have a question.
Thank you very much for breaking the thing. I was pleased when you said that, relatively speaking, technology existing as communication existing, because that's been my experience, and many people think otherwise. But what has been done to, are there any standardized protocols? How do we implement, how do we train people, how do we incorporate it in the workflow? It's a lot of work, and it's very hard to develop it from scratch. So I've seen some manuals from Herbert Echo.
Yeah, there's a ton of resources out there. The American Telemedicine Association, as Dr. Krupinski mentioned, has standards and guidelines and a lot of great documents out there to help form those. The telehealth resource centers have access to a lot of different resources like that. Where are you from?
New York.
So I can give you my card, and if you want to touch base after, we can certainly help with that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It is just
and
about
almost
two.
All the resource centers have training programs that you can either go to, or at the ATA meeting, there's training programs. So
one last question in the back, because it is just about two.
I was just curious if there's conversations happening around the nation that are using this as, when we look at our emergency preparedness, we look pretty grateful for like isolation and quarantine.
Yeah, there's a huge group that's looking at disaster telehealth, and it's actually been used in any number of events, the earthquakes and the hurricanes, and like I'm forgetting where all these were in recent years. You see them on the news, but all the big ones, the big earthquakes, the big hurricanes, there's always been a telehealth component. It never gets on the news. The military is using telemedicine in disaster relief, and there's a whole within the ATA, a special interest group specifically on that topic. So, yeah, it is very much so being used.
Great. Thank you very much. So let's just one big round of applause. Thank you.